Welcome to Lymphoma and Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Laurie Sen from the British Columbia Cancer Agency at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And to begin, I asked her about a recent case sent to me by a community-based oncologist, Dr. Ranju Gupta.
This patient is presenting with quite a dramatic presentation of what appears to be a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So they have acute onset of symptoms, they have widespread involvement, and one of the interesting things here is that they have quite a number of unusual extranodal sites. So certainly we know that diffuse large B-cell lymphoma can go anywhere, but you know, the majority of patients present with nodal-based disease. It can involve the bone marrow and sometimes extranodal sites, but every now and then we see patients that have widespread involvement and numerous extranodal sites, and we know that those patients do generally have more aggressive behaving disease, and the number of extranodal sites does portend a poorer prognosis. So when I see a new patient like this, I want to make sure that I'm gathering all the information right from the beginning. Of course, they need to be fully staged, but most importantly, we need to understand what the pathology really shows. So most importantly, right now, what we do understand is that FISH testing is highly important to separate out the small but relevant group of patients that we call double hit lymphoma. So it's recommended that all patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma have FISH testing for BCL2, MYC, and BCL6. And particularly the dual translocation of MYC and BCL2 has really been shown to be associated with a poorer prognosis. And most physicians are starting to treat those patients differently because what we do recognize is that R-CHOP is probably not going to be good enough for them. The real question is, you know, what's better than R-CHOP for a patient with double-hit lymphoma? And that remains really unproven at this point. It's a small group of patients. So we have no randomized trials. So we really just have retrospective data to rely on. What we do know is that it seems from retrospective data that more intensive chemotherapy looks to lead to a better outcome in double hit lymphoma. And so dose-adjusted EPOCH-R, which is a very intensive infusion-based regimen, has, I think, become kind of the preferred regimen for patients with double hit lymphoma until we probably get more data that points to something else. So in my own clinic, if I have a newly diagnosed patient with double hit lymphoma, I would start treatment with dose-adjusted EPOCH-R as long as they don't have a contraindication for it.
What do you think about the idea that since she couldn't get back the FISH when she wanted to treat the patient, to go ahead and use R-EPOCH until you get back the FISH? You ever do that?
I think the important thing is to try and get the FISH back as soon as you can so you can fine-tune the therapy based on the results. I agree, you know, most of us don't necessarily have that information before we start treatment, particularly these patients with aggressive behaving disease. You can't really wait out that information all the time. I personally tend to start R-CHOP in those patients and then escalate to dose-adjusted EPOCH-R just because of the logistical complexity of starting dose-adjusted EPOCH-R in patients that I usually default to R-CHOP. And keep in mind that 95% of patients are going to have standard risk cytogenetics. So you're really looking for that 5, maybe 8% of patients that have the double hit. So I think it's fair to do either. The important thing is to pay attention to the information and then fine-tune the treatment. But I would tend to do, you know, start with the R-CHOP and then escalate if the results indicate double hit.
Anything about the phenotype here that would suggest double hit?
So when we look back at the retrospective compilation of data that we have, there really aren't any clinical features or pathologic features that can really predict it well enough. So I think what's happened is historically, it wasn't routinely tested on all patients. So some of the literature is skewed into suggesting that it's only those patients with aggressive behaving disease that are likely to be double hit. And the reality is now that we're universally testing all patients, we realize that we're probably missing a lot of patients before that had really very mundane presentations with non-aggressive behaving disease. And what we're seeing is we test all patients, it's really hard to predict based on behavior alone or any pathologic characteristics.
So Dr. Gupta also raises the question of should R-squared CHOP adding in lenalidomide. So obviously this is being studied in randomized trial. The patient does have germinal center subtype. What do you think about doing that off study?
So the reality is all patients with double hit lymphoma, the dual translocation of MYC and BCL2, will be of GCB subtype. We really don't have any data looking at the utility of lenalidomide in patients with double hit lymphoma. I think based on how we know lenalidomide works in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and based on some early data, it's anticipated that it's likely to be a more useful drug for the ABC subtype rather than a GCB subtype. I'd have to say that I personally wouldn't be using it without real data to show that it actually is beneficial.
So this patient actually, at this point, we don't know that this is double hit, and she's just responding to the issue of assuming that you don't have a double hit, just based on the GC subtype, would it be reasonable to add in lenalidomide?
I would say no, because again, moving forward, we know that it's the ABC subtype that will most likely benefit. Those clinical trials are being done. We'll get more answers. But until we have, you know, demonstration that it is a value, this is the kind of subtype that I wouldn't necessarily expect it to have a big impact in.
So a couple other questions she brings up. Should she check the CSF? What about an MRI of the brain? What about CNS prophylaxis?
And that is an excellent question that continues to be debated again and again. So we know that CNS risk is a real problem, and it's a real problem because once patients recur in the CNS, they become extremely difficult to treat, and very often it's a fatal event. So there is utility probably in picking up these cases early, patients that harbor CNS involvement at the time of presentation that we might not recognize, or those patients at higher risk and intervening at a time when we might actually treat early disease or prevent recurrence. Ultimately, we do now have what's called a CNS IPI, and that's a risk factor model trying to predict patients at highest risk of CNS involvement. And I would encourage anybody to look up the CNS IPI, which has been recently published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. But essentially, it's a risk model that includes the IPI factors as well as the presence of adrenal or renal involvement as the predictors for higher risk of CNS involvement. And based on that risk model, about 10% of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma fall in the higher risk category of CNS involvement, meaning that they have at least probably a 10% risk of CNS progression in the future. That means 90% of patients actually fall in the low to intermediate categories, and their risk is quite low, being probably certainly under 5% and probably under 3%. So it doesn't make sense to provide prophylaxis to everybody. What we really are interested in is trying to find the higher risk patients and considering whether or not they warrant prophylaxis. For this particular case that you're talking about, I don't know all of the factors that are necessary to calculate the CNS IPI risk in this patient. But the thing that does worry me about this patient is the multiple extranodal sites, which has been shown by a lot of people to increase the risk of CNS recurrence in the future. So I have to say, based on the constellation of findings in this patient, it is somebody that I would pursue testing for the possibility of CNS involvement. So normally what we would do is an MRI of the brain to look for any evidence of CNS involvement. And also we would do an LP looking for cytologic evidence of CNS involvement, but also sending that for flow cytometry because it can pick up very subtle and early evidence of CNS involvement.
And what are the situations where you do CNS prophylaxis and how do you do it?
So if we still don't have real data to show the value of CNS prophylaxis, but more and more the data looking at intrathecal prophylaxis, which used to be routinely done and recommended before, so intrathecal methotrexate, for example, that's looking to be not very effective. So in my own clinic, we're no longer giving intrathecal methotrexate as prophylaxis because we don't think it works. So if a patient is at significant risk for CNS recurrence, you know, based on what we just talked about, I would be looking to try and treat them with some systemic methotrexate. In our protocol, we actually use 4 doses of methotrexate that we try to deliver over the course of the 6 cycles of R-CHOP. And the dose of methotrexate that we're using is kind of a medium dose, so 3.5 grams per meter squared. I would administer in my own clinic usually after 4 cycles of treatment, and then give the remaining 2 at the end of treatment, so after cycle 6. But again, that's just our practice. My primary goal is to make sure that I'm not derailing the R-CHOP. So the one treatment we know the patient needs is the R-CHOP chemotherapy. And if you overwhelm them by bringing in another toxic drug and they can't finish the 6 cycles of R-CHOP, well, then I think you've actually harmed them rather than helped them by trying to bring in that methotrexate. So I think it takes balancing out the patient's age, their comorbidities, and their overall tolerance of chemotherapy. But, you know, if a patient is certainly under the age of 70, if they don't have any serious comorbidities, I would think about bringing in that methotrexate and try to administer it in between cycles of R-CHOP. And I think when you give it and sort of the timing of it is probably up to patient tolerance, but I aim to give 4 treatments with the whole package of R-CHOP.
What's your best estimate of what this does to the risk of CNS relapse? I don't know that there's a whole lot of data.
There isn't a whole lot of data, you know, and I don't think that anybody has systematically treated patients. So even in, from retrospective data, it's hard to look back and to estimate whether or not this is impacting. So I think that we've got enough data from the retrospective compilation of information we have to suggest that intrathecal therapy doesn't look helpful. So many of us have moved to the systemic therapy, and I think time will tell whether or not we can determine its benefit. But right now, I'd have to say we just don't have the data to know what it's going to do in terms of impacting that risk.
So I know you've been very interested in this issue of CNS relapse. I see you had a paper in Cancer in 2017, the number of extranodal sites assessed by PET CT is a powerful predictor. And you had another paper in the British Journal of Hematology specifically on testicular involvement. Can you talk about that work?
Yeah, so as I said, we're starting to understand a little bit more in terms of the risk factors that might weigh into CNS risk. Right now, I already mentioned the CNS IPI as one of the things that we should probably calculate on patients, and that's the IPI score together with the presence of adrenal or renal involvement. But independent from that CNS IPI score as a tool that we can use to predict risk, there do seem to be other parameters that probably do weigh in to risk. And one of those is the number of extranodal sites. And in this patient that we're talking about, that's the risk that I'm most concerned about here, is they have at least 4 extranodal sites of involvement that I would say significantly increase their risk of CNS involvement based on that data that you're pointing to. The other unique entity where we need to be really aware of the risk of CNS involvement is primary testicular diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So that, again, is sort of a rare presentation of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but the unique feature with it is it does substantially increase the risk of CNS involvement. So for that particular entity, we do recommend CNS prophylaxis in all of our patients. And that prophylaxis would be with systemic methotrexate because, you know, the majority of the patients with primary testicular lymphoma that have CNS involvement have it within the parenchyma of the brain rather than leptomeningeal. And so I think the utility of intrathecal prophylaxis really doesn't make a lot of sense at all for primary testicular.
Are you talking about CNS or testicular?
I'm talking right now about primary testicular lymphoma, and they do have a higher risk of CNS involvement and relapse within the CNS. And when they do relapse, most of the time it's not as leptomeningeal involvement or involvement of the CSF fluid, but almost always they present with intraparenchymal brain lesions as their evidence of metastases. So I think most people feel that it's never made sense to consider intrathecal methotrexate as a prophylaxis for those patients based on the biology where we see them have relapse deep in the brain tissue, which is why we think that if you're going to give them prophylaxis, it really should be with IV methotrexate.
Right. When you talk about testicular involvement of diffuse large B-cell, are you talking just about primary testicular diffuse large B-cell, or do you also see that the testes can be one of the sites of disease, but there's disease elsewhere?
Yeah, so I'm specifically talking about primary testicular diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Occasionally, we see patients who have widespread disease, but it's really hard to know if it's also involving the testicular region, whether or not it originated there or not. So I think it's going to come down to, there's not a whole lot of data to suggest if the patient has widespread disease, but also has testicular involvement, is that a risk factor? Because it may have been that it was an initial primary testicular that's just widespread. So I think clinical judgment is going to have to be used in that rare circumstance where it's not clear if it's primary testicular or not. But most of the data we have relates to primary testicular diffuse large B-cell lymphoma as increasing the risk.
So one final question about this case from Dr. Gupta, something I never heard about. I'm not sure it exists, you tell me, which is the issue specifically when you have gastric or bowel involvement of diffuse large B-cell, I guess maybe the concern about perforation or whatever, but to avoid anthracyclines in the first cycle. Have you ever heard of that? Do you ever do that?
So there may be two issues being raised here, and one is the risk of gastric perforation when you start chemotherapy. So we do know that patients who have gastric involvement are at risk of perforation. That risk is probably not as high as we originally thought from some of the older literature, but looking at it now, I think that that risk is probably about 5% across the board. So it's a real risk, but it's not very high. I think the most important thing we can do for these patients is get good control over the lymphoma and get that control quickly. So I don't think it personally makes sense to hold back any of the chemotherapy because there's no evidence to suggest that that's going to decrease their risk of gastric perforation. And I think what you're really aiming to do is get control of their lymphoma. So I would say that I would want to come in with a full dose chemotherapy. The other question that might be raised, though, is that from time to time when we have patients that have a large amount of bowel involvement, so more specifically maybe small bowel or colon involvement where there is impending obstruction of the bowel itself, we do worry about giving the vincristine component of the chemotherapy because vincristine can cause slowing of the bowel. And if there's imminent bowel obstruction because of the lymphoma and then the patient gets an ileus related to the vincristine, that can actually put them into a full-blown bowel obstruction. So in my own practice, if somebody has near-pending bowel obstruction, I would likely omit the vincristine from the first cycle to avoid that from happening.
So I could ask you, how would you manage this patient or a patient like this if the patient had relapse? But actually, you have a case that kind of is similar to that. So maybe we can hear about your 62-year-old man.
Yeah, so I think one of the more difficult situations we deal with is relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So recently I saw a patient in my own clinic who presented with stage 4B diffuse large B-cell lymphoma where interestingly, his disease was largely confined to the abdomen. He had a very large abdominal mass in the mesentery, but it was also invading into the pancreas, and he also had extensive disease eroding into the iliac bone. So locally, very aggressive and advanced. He actually pathologically had an ABC subtype of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and he received treatment with our standard, which is 6 cycles of R-CHOP. Unfortunately, although he appeared to be responding at the partway assessment, which I usually do after 3 or 4 cycles, by the time we restaged him after 6 cycles, it was clear that his PET scan was very positive, particularly in that area around the pancreas and the mesenteric mass. And compared to his partway staging CT scan, it appeared to be growing. So he had an initial response that was incomplete. And by the time we got to the end of his 6 cycles, he actually had progressing disease. So This is probably the most difficult patient that we manage and what we would refer to as primary refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, people that don't even get into an initial complete response. What we do know is that these patients are very difficult to ultimately cure, although he is relatively young and would tolerate intensive therapy. So we went down our usual route of proceeding on to a salvage chemotherapy regimen. There are a number of salvage chemotherapy regimens that can be used. I think the ones people choose tend to depend on their local preference or what they use geographically. In my own clinic, we use GDPR, which is a gemcitabine platinum-based regimen, but R-ICE is frequently used, or R-DHAP, and I would say that all of these regimens are probably equally effective. What we use them for is to try and debulk the patient, try and prove that they have chemosensitive disease, because if they have chemosensitive disease, the goal is still to get them toward an autologous stem cell transplant, which is really the only maneuver that we know that has proven cure capacity in this situation. So for this patient, we went on to give him RGDP, and he had initially some benefit. I would call it a partial benefit, but I hate to say that before he actually made it to transplant, he was already progressing. So demonstrated refractoriness to the salvage therapy.
And what happened?
Yeah, so in the past, my inkling was often to push ahead and try another salvage regimen. But the reality is that we do have data to suggest that once patients fail one salvage regimen, the likelihood that they're going to respond to a second salvage is probably in the range of 5 to 10% at best. So instead of going that route, we actually elected to go ahead and put him on a clinical trial that we have of a novel bispecific antibody in hopes that that might provide him with benefit that we can't seem to accomplish with his chemotherapy and sensitive disease. And he's just started on that clinical trial.
So this story, you know, certainly has been around for a long time, but now we have a new player obviously on the block in terms of CAR T therapy in the United States that's actually approved for diffuse large B cell. Can you talk about your take on what we know about CAR T?
And
you know, thinking back to this case, if you could, where do you see CAR T is going to fit into a case like this?
Yeah. So I'm really glad you brought that up because obviously that is one of the most topical things going on right now in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So the first CAR T-cell product was approved for relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma by the FDA. Now is becoming available in the United States as a potential option for a patient like this. Sitting in Canada, unfortunately, we're in a bit of a limbo state where we don't have it yet available. So going back when I was managing this patient just before the new year, you know, it's not something that I could have offered him. I think that this is the kind of patient that would be a very desirable approach for, because there are patients treated within those CAR T-cell trials who, despite not responding to chemotherapy and not responding to salvage therapy, did go on to receive CAR T-cell with excellent benefit and durable benefit. So I think we're still in early days with the CAR T-cell information. So it does look like a proportion of patients with very chemotherapy-resistant diffuse large B-cell lymphoma can potentially get good benefit from CAR T-cell therapy, and some patients actually can achieve a complete remission and durable responses. But a lot of the data is still early, meaning that we have relatively short follow-up. At the most recent ASH meeting, we actually saw several of these trials reported, including an update of the trial, which does reflect the product that's now been approved on the market in the FDA. And if you look at their data, you know, across the board, about 40% of patients were able to achieve a sustained complete remission at the time of their last evaluation. So that, when you think about it, is quite remarkable. I mean, for a patient like this, I don't have anything that I could take off the shelf that I would be confident would provide him with any kind of durable benefit. And to think that a CAR T-cell approach might offer him a 40% chance of benefit is quite remarkable. So I think that would be a strong goal and motivation. The one caveat I would state is that for many of the CAR T-cell trials, in order to participate, because it does take a while from the time the patient is sort of initiated along the path to CAR T-cell to actually create the CAR T-cell product, so approximately a three-week duration from start to finish to getting the product available, patients do have to have some disease stability, I think, going into that procedure. So in the patient that I'm talking about, I think that given the aggressiveness of his disease, it's unlikely we could have kind of gone straight on to CAR T-cell therapy. I think he would have needed something as a lead-in. The trials that we've seen with the product that's been approved, those trials did not allow for lead-in chemotherapy to develop. So I think there was some patient selection going on there. These were perhaps patients that had achieved some disease stability, where some of the other trials allowed for chemotherapy lead-in. But ultimately, if you have a patient that has disease that's very much out of control, you're going to need to use something to get them into control to, I think, lead into the CAR T-cell approach.
Where do you see a CAR T-cell therapy sort of landing after the trials get done? And I guess one thing that I've heard about that is very interesting, I've heard people talk about, is the idea that maybe in the future we're going to do it before transplant or in lieu of transplant, and even potentially up front in patients with very poor outcomes such as double hit. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, again, this is relatively new technology and we're learning more all the time about its potential. But I think what's really enticing here is that the data we have so far shows that there are some patients who have failed our standard approaches, including autologous stem cell transplant, and have achieved remarkable durable benefit from CAR T-cell. So it does beg the question of whether or not it could challenge autologous stem cell transplant in terms of being either a better approach or equal but maybe less toxic approach down the road. So there is a study plan, at least one study that I'm aware of, that will actually sort of pit it against stem cell transplant, where patients will be, at the time of relapse, randomized to our standard salvage and autologous stem cell transplant approach versus CAR T cells. And I think, you know, it'll take that randomized controlled trial to answer that question of whether or not it should be done ahead of a stem cell transplant. It also begs the question for patients like the double hit scenario that we talked about, where we know those patients are quite chemotherapy insensitive, whether or not using this as an approach earlier might offer, you know, a modality that they can achieve benefit from. So that these are all questions that need to be explored, but they really need to be explored within the context of clinical trials.
So let's move on now, talk a little bit about Hodgkin lymphoma. And of course, I want to get your take on the Echelon 1 study. But before we get into that, maybe you can just begin by talking about your 31-year-old man.
Yeah, so I recently saw a patient who I think many people would say is a fairly standard presentation of Hodgkin lymphoma. So a 31-year-old gentleman, really no comorbidities, illnesses, presented with a lump in his neck, was actually feeling quite well. And when we biopsied that, it demonstrated classical Hodgkin lymphoma. We staged him and he was found to have stage 2B disease in that he had bilateral neck involvement and mediastinal involvement. And, you know, on questioning, he did have some night sweats that had developed over the last several months. So stage 2B disease. So he went on to receive ABVD treatment, which is still our standard approach for upfront Hodgkin lymphoma when he was treated, received 6 cycles, actually did very well with that, achieved a PET CR. But at about the 18-month mark on routine follow-up, he did start to have new symptoms of difficulty swallowing. And I have to say, it was a bit of a diagnostic dilemma at first, because when we staged him, he didn't have clear new progressive lymph glands. He had maybe some thickening adjacent to the esophagus, and we weren't really sure what was going on till actually it was on a endoscopic biopsy through the esophagus that we were actually able to determine that he in fact had relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma, which was unusually not necessarily presenting as nodal involvement, but presenting as this extranodal soft tissue component adjacent to his esophagus. So he then went on to our standard approach at that point, which, again, would be salvage chemotherapy. Here we use GDP, but there are a number of salvage chemotherapies that can be used followed by stem cell transplant, so autologous stem cell transplant. And he obtained a very excellent response to that with a complete remission post-autologous stem cell transplant. And as per our usual approach now, he is now receiving maintenance therapy with brentuximab.
So could I maybe go through a couple aspects of the case, both the initial presentation as well as the management on relapse? Let's start with the issue of upfront therapy. And I'd like to ask you, if this patient presented today and you sort of put aside cost and regulatory issues, what do you think is the best therapy in this situation? And specifically, can you comment on the Echelon 1 study, what they looked at, and what you think it means?
Yeah, so this is all information, I'd say, that's relatively new that we're all starting to grapple with. So I must admit that the Echelon study was presented at ASH by my close colleague, Dr. Connors, but giving you my unbiased opinion, and the feedback I'm hearing from clinicians out there is that they're trying to figure out whether or not they should be changing their practice based on what was presented. So what we learned from Echelon was that this was a very large study done in the untreated patient population with Hodgkin lymphoma, so the upfront treatment. And it essentially was a head-to-head comparison of our standard approach of ABVD chemotherapy versus AVD, so ABVD with the bleomycin omitted, but adding in the brentuximab. And what we learned from that study was that the novel combination with the brentuximab included did result in a higher modified progression-free survival. So in the end, patients who received the novel combination had a slightly better chance of remaining progression-free and not requiring other therapy for their Hodgkin lymphoma. At this point in time, I think what's being questioned is, was the benefit seen enough to justify the added cost of the brentuximab, both in terms of its monetary cost, but also in terms of its cost of toxicity? So the use of brentuximab did lead to higher risk of neutropenia. These patients certainly needed to be supported with growth factor, white blood cell growth factor support. There was a higher risk of neurotoxicity. What we learned from the presentation is most of the toxicity risk was quite manageable and temporary, and much of the neuropathy resolved. But nonetheless, it is a more intensive combination with a higher risk. So I think, you know, we're basically looking at that data really closely right now and trying to weigh in the risk benefit of it. But I'd have to say that it's been 40 years now that we've been using the ABVD treatment for Hodgkin lymphoma, and this is really an exciting novel combination that did lead to an improved progression-free survival in a group of patients. So I think it's likely to become, over time, the preferred regimen for Hodgkin lymphoma, although, as I said, it'll probably be something that needs to be considered on an individual patient-by-patient basis and with that slight added toxicity kept in mind.
So let's talk a little bit about relapse disease. And in this case, you use consolidation bevacizumab, and that was obviously looked at in the so-called ATHERA trial. Can you talk about what that trial looked at and how you apply that to your patients and why you decided to give this patient consolidation, and what are some situations where you wouldn't have used it?
Yeah, so the ATHERA trial was a randomized trial that looked at the use of brentuximab, vedotin. You can call it consolidation, you can call it maintenance therapy, but the use of brentuximab, vedotin after autologous stem cell transplant for relapsed refractory Hodgkin lymphoma. And in that trial, they did select patients that would be considered slightly higher risk. So they included patients with primary refractory Hodgkin lymphoma or patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma that would be considered higher risk, those that relapsed within 12 months or those that had an extranodal involvement at the time of their relapse. And in that randomized controlled trial, what we learned was that patients who received the brentuximab vedotin for a year, the plan was to give them 16 doses over the course of a year's time. Patients who went down that route actually had a much improved progression-free survival. At the time the trial was analyzed, there was no overall survival benefit, but it was still very early days since we know patients do have other therapies that they can receive following relapse. But given the substantial improvement in progression-free survival, you know, we're hopeful that this might actually improve the cure rate post-autologous transplant in some patients. So in our own clinic, we do offer patients brentuximab vedotin maintenance after stem cell transplant. As I said, the study did enroll higher risk patients, and the patient I just described would fall into that high risk category because he had really was an extranodal recurrence of this disease. Although I think you really have to look at that data and say, is there any rationale that other patients who are undergoing stem cell transplant from, you know, for Hodgkin lymphoma wouldn't benefit? Just because the trial picked out the high-risk population, does it mean that it might not offer benefit to other patients? I personally think that all patients that relapse with Hodgkin lymphoma are of relatively high risk. So we don't make a distinction based on their presentation at relapse, but we're really offering it to anybody following autologous stem cell transplant, regardless of whether or not we perceive them to be high risk as defined by the ATHERA trial or not, because in my mind, they all potentially might benefit.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like reminds me of the paradigm, you know, I think in adjuvant therapy of solid tumors like breast cancer, where, you know, a lot of the trials focus on people with higher risk because it's kind of easier to demonstrate the benefit. And then people assume that it's going to apply down the line. Now, this patient, has he completed the year of bevacizumab?
I have to admit, he got to about cycle 8, and then we actually had to stop because he did have cumulative neuropathy that forced us to actually stop it. While the goal is, according to the ATHERA trial, to give them up to 16 doses, which takes a year to administer. I have to say many patients didn't get through the full 16 doses on that trial, either because of neuropathy that developed over time or cytopenias, because you have to remember these patients are coming off a lot of therapy and the stem cell transplant. But regardless, the benefit was seen in the patients that were taken down the route of maintenance. So I think that the goal is, as long as the patient doesn't have a contraindication, to administer the maintenance, and then it needs to be tailored to patient tolerance. But I think probably what we learned from the trial is going down that route seems to provide benefit, even though not everybody is probably going to get through the 16 cycles.
What exactly did he experience in terms of neuropathy? And sort of in general, how much neuropathy does it take for you to stop treatment?
So most of these patients do develop a peripheral neuropathy that typically can present initially as a sensory neuropathy with tingling and numbness in the fingers and toes. So very similar to what we see with vincristine that we routinely use, for example, with R-CHOP. But it is a little bit different. So drugs like brentuximab vedotin much more typically can cause also a painful neuropathy. So he started to develop very painful sensation in his fingers primarily that was really debilitating for him. You know, there is a grading scale for neuropathy, and grade 2 would suggest a patient that really it is starting to impact quite significantly their daily activities. So I would say that once a patient has grade 2 or higher neuropathy that manifests itself, that's usually a point in time when I would stop.
So one other issue about Hodgkin lymphoma I'd like to query you about relates to checkpoint inhibitors. I'd like to know kind of in general where you're utilizing these agents and what your experience has been in terms of the clinical benefit and risk.
Yeah, I have to say that, you know, that is another extremely exciting development in the world of Hodgkin lymphoma. So there are two drugs that we have the most data on right now, and that's pembrolizumab and nivolumab, so both PD-1 inhibitors. And the data right now really has explored their use in patients with multiply relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. So mainly patients who have already gone through all of the standard therapies and nonetheless had their lymphoma recur. So patients who, in all intents and purposes, we would consider to no longer have any curative options. And, you know, what we've seen is remarkably high overall response rate, so ranging from 65 to 80% with those drugs, and many of them have been very durable and providing patients with years of benefit. And again, it's early days in terms of the results we have from that data as well, but you know, at the time of last reporting, there were many patients who remained in durable remission with no sign of disease. So I think we do question whether or not that might have some long-term impact and even offer some patients a chance of cure. But that's really speculative. Right now, we know that it offers a very effective palliative approach for patients who no longer have cured options for Hodgkin lymphoma. So given the real benefit we're seeing with those drugs, it does beg the question, should they be moved earlier? So right now, they're primarily approved and indicated for relapse refractory Hodgkin lymphoma. So in my own clinic, I'm using them once patients have relapsed following all of our standard therapies when I no longer have kind of a curative option. For patients, for example, who fail autologous stem cell transplant, my next drug would probably be brentuximab vedotin if they haven't already had it or failed it in maintenance. Mainly, I guess, because that drug was out first, but we also have some suggestion from the initial pivotal trial that was done with brentuximab vedotin that there is a proportion of patients that sustained ongoing long-term control, suggesting that it might offer cure for some patients who have failed stem cell transplant. And so probably I would use it in patients who are no longer benefiting from brentuximab vedotin. But it does, as I say, beg the question where it really should fit in. And of course, clinical trials are being designed to bring it in earlier, either in part of the salvage regimen as maintenance therapy post-transplant, and ultimately into the frontline treatment.
We actually did a symposium at ASH that you were part of, and we had a couple of really cool Hodgkin cases. The two cases that we presented that you might remember that there was a lot of debate about, one was an elderly woman who was previously healthy, I think she was in her 80s, but was totally debilitated by Hodgkin lymphoma presenting with severe B symptoms. And there was a lot of debate, you know, and brought up this whole issue of management of the very elderly. I don't know how often you see that. And I think of that because, of course, people think about checkpoint inhibitors and bevacizumab in the frail older patient. Although in that case, I recall there was some sentiment that a patient like that ought to get chemotherapy. But any thoughts about the older frail patient like the one we presented?
Yeah. So we know Hodgkin lymphoma is a very curable lymphoma for some patients, but in order to cure them right now, we still think that they need to be able to tolerate the chemotherapy that's previously been shown to be curative, which is a drug combination like ABVD. And the reality is, for that rarer patient that presents who is very elderly, and this patient that you're describing in their 80s, it is really hard to give six cycles of ABVD to that patient. So I think it's really logical to explore other possibilities. You know, the literature does have some sort of watered-down chemotherapy versions for older patients, but I don't think we have a lot of data to know whether or not that's going to offer a cure to patients down the road. And given the real benefit of some of these novel agents in Hodgkin lymphoma and, you know, their relative good side effect profile, I think it does make sense if you admit that there's no way you can get this kind of patient through the standard type of ABVD, then I think these novel agents become very desirable as a way to try and keep control over the disease, get benefit, put that patient into hopefully a nice response by minimizing the side effects while you do it. And we don't know the long-term potential of these drugs in the upfront setting.
Any specific regimen? A number of regimens were discussed. Some people were talking about bevacizumab alone, bevacizumab with chemo like DTIC, bevacizumab and checkpoint inhibitor alone. Any particular approach you've taken?
No. So, you know, again, working in Canada in my own clinic, it's a challenge to obtain some of these drugs in the upfront setting. Brentuximab is one of the drugs that I can get for my patients upfront if I declare them to be not a candidate for chemotherapy. So that's probably the drug that I've used the most in this kind of a setting as a single agent. And, you know, as I said, I've seen some really nice durable responses with really minimal side effects using it upfront in a palliative way. But in terms of those other combinations that you're talking about, I think we're starting to see the data emerge. They all seem very rational, with the goal here being to try and get something effective to keep the lymphoma under control and minimize the side effects. But none of them have been compared against each other. So again, I think it's going to need to be a very individual approach, need to think about the patient, need to think about what their comorbidities are. We do have concerns about brentuximab and neuropathy. So if it's a patient with underlying neuropathy from other causes, you probably want to avoid that drug, in which case the PD-1 inhibitor would be much more attractive. But right now, we don't have a way of comparing those. I think they're all making a whole lot of sense, but it's probably going to be a matter of individualizing it on a patient-by-patient basis.
So another case we presented that to me was absolutely fascinating was a younger patient with Hodgkin lymphoma who relapsed and ended up getting a checkpoint inhibitor. And the patient had severe pneumonitis, ended up in the ICU, hypoxic, got through the whole thing. But the doc who presented it, a general oncologist who's used a lot of checkpoint inhibitors, lung cancer, et cetera, was commenting how impressive this was. But most interestingly, that the patient had had bleomycin-associated pneumonitis with upfront therapy with ABVD. And he wanted to know whether there's any correlation between the two. Craig Moskowitz is on that panel, and I guess the data doesn't support that. But what has been your experience in terms of tolerability and toxicity issues? Have you seen autoimmune problems? Have you seen pneumonitis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, these are drugs that are new to many doctors who treat primarily lymphoma. So I think some of the doctors who treat solid tumors have probably used these types of drugs for a longer period of time than we've had access to them. But, you know, I think one of the unique things about now using them for Hodgkin lymphoma is that what we're seeing is that many of these patients have very excellent benefit and very durable benefit. So in the big picture, we might actually be using them for longer periods of time for Hodgkin lymphoma than in some patients with solid tumors where they might be used on a more shorter term scale, which means that toxicities that can develop, we may not see them initially, but need to be aware that these things can develop over time. So clearly, these drugs have a very unique side effect profile that doctors do need to be aware of. Autoimmune complications are certainly part of the picture of that side effect profile, and that can manifest in many ways. So we've seen pneumonitis develop. We've seen colitis develop. I recently had a patient who developed, and this was a very young patient, really interesting case actually, of a young orthopedic resident who had Hodgkin lymphoma and was receiving nivolumab in the context of an upfront clinical trial where we're trying to bring the nivolumab in prior to the ABVD. And while receiving the nivolumab, and it actually continued the drug during ABVD as well. But I stress this is a clinical trial. I wouldn't do this outside of a clinical trial. But she had been receiving the drug and developed a really profound arthritic condition, so much so that all of the joints in her body were affected to the point that she could hardly walk up the stairs. And this had been somebody who didn't miss a day of her residency training while she was getting her treatment, and then very abruptly developed this widespread arthritis that was very debilitating, which I had her actually seen by a rheumatologist who agreed that this had to be related to the nivolumab use and was an autoimmune reaction to the PD-1 inhibitor. So in her case, we did, of course, stop the drug, and she actually landed up being treated with a course of steroids. And I would say over the course of about a month of time, this actually resolved nicely and has gone on to completely resolve. But there is a wide spectrum of autoimmune phenomenon that can occur with these drugs, and they don't necessarily occur right away.
And what did you do in terms of, well, she was in a complete remission?
Yeah, so interestingly, again, within the context of this clinical trial, she had received the nivolumab prior to ABVD for a couple of months and then received it through the ABVD. This complication didn't develop until pretty much her final cycle. So she had been on the drug for about 8 months of time at that point and fortunately was actually finishing up her chemotherapy. So we didn't have to worry about giving her any more treatment at that point. What we had to do was figure out how we were going to try and improve her symptoms. And so all the drugs were stopped and she was treated with steroids and she was in a complete remission.
That trial, though, sounds really interesting. The idea of giving a checkpoint inhibitor alone before you give anything else, but being able to look at what the effect of a checkpoint inhibitor is by itself. I actually became aware of a study like that that was done in lung cancer at Memorial recently. And to my surprise, and I think the investigators, they had like 40% in lung cancer, either a CR or very good response. You would expect in Hodgkin lymphoma, maybe it'd be even better. What do we know right now about giving a checkpoint inhibitor alone upfront in HL?
Yeah, so we don't know very much. So that trial that I'm mentioning has not yet been reported, but we certainly look forward to the results. And the nice thing about that design is we will learn something about what it can accomplish upfront when given alone as a single drug, at least initially. So there's really no data to rely on right now in terms of the untreated patient population. But fortunately, that information will be coming.
That'll be fascinating to see. Let's move on now and talk a little bit about another interest of yours that you've done a lot of work in, specifically follicular lymphoma. And I'm kind of curious now, it's been a year since we've seen the data with the so-called gallium study looking at obinutuzumab as opposed to rituximab in follicular lymphoma. So I want to get your take 1 year later about how that sort of settled out, at least in your own mind at your center. Maybe we can get into that, though, about hearing about your 72-year-old lady.
Yeah, so follicular lymphoma is the most common indolent lymphoma that we treat. And this 72-year-old woman presented with some of the typical things that we see with follicular lymphoma, although I'd have to say a little bit more of an aggressive presentation than I see in most of my patients. So she presented with a pretty rapid presentation of widespread, I would say her initial finding was actually she presented with abdominal symptoms of bloating and fullness in her abdomen. And when we evaluated her, we did see that she had some evidence of widespread low bulk lymphadenopathy, which she had become aware of over the preceding months. But on staging, the bulk of her disease was really in the abdomen, and she had a very large abdominal mass that was very bulky that was the source of her symptoms. Other things, she did have evidence of bone marrow involvement as well, and was notably anemic with a hemoglobin that was causing her to be quite fatigued. So when we biopsied her, we actually obtained a biopsy from the retroperitoneal mass, and as typical in a situation like that, we were relying on a core biopsy, and it indicated follicular lymphoma grade 1 or 2. I have to say that based on the extent of disease in her abdomen, fairly abrupt presentation of symptoms, I was worried about whether or not this lady harbored a transformation to an aggressive lymphoma. But we did obtain the biopsy from the site of a biggest worry for transformation, and it only showed follicular lymphoma. We also got a PET scan, and that had an SUV that lit up in the area that was kind of modest. And what I would say was that SUV of 7 was the maximum and kind of modest and in keeping with just a low-grade lymphoma. And her LDH was within the normal limits, as was her calcium. So other than the large mass and fairly abrupt presentation, there wasn't a whole lot to argue for transformation. So we assume that this lady did, in fact, have follicular lymphoma as her primary problem. But, you know, if you look at her presentation, her features, she does have a high-risk score on the FLIPI index. She's 72. And I think the goal in a patient like this, and it probably is the goal for all patients, but more so in a patient who's elderly, who might have more limited options down the road, I think what we want to do is to come in with the most effective treatment that has a reasonable toxicity profile that can get her disease under control and ultimately obtain prolonged control over lymphoma so she can go back to her normal life, not needing to have this treated for a very prolonged period of time. And right now, we still don't have curative treatment for follicular lymphoma, but we have very excellent treatment that can provide patients with durable control. The standard treatment has really relied on chemotherapy and rituximab as the upfront treatment. We here use bendamustine as our preferred chemotherapy, as many people have now reverted to. And so bendamustine and rituximab has been our upfront approach, followed by rituximab maintenance. And that's the treatment that this patient went on to receive. We saw the big presentation of gallium, which was the head-to-head comparison of obinutuzumab versus rituximab administered with chemotherapy. And it was institution choice chemotherapy. So in that trial, patients could have received either CHOP or CVP or bendamustine. But what the trial showed was that patients who received the obinutuzumab, they actually had a better progression-free survival than patients that received the rituximab. So what initially was reported was the 2 to 3 year progression-free survival rate, and it was about approximately 6 to 7% higher with the obinutuzumab. It did come with a little bit of a trade-off, though, and that trade-off was, of course, a higher risk of infusion-related reactions, which generally are manageable with obinutuzumab and not something of great concern in my mind, but a slightly higher risk of infection and neutropenia as well. So I think, you know, based on that data, it was shown to be a better regimen. So the obinutuzumab does seem to be a better antibody than rituximab for follicular lymphoma, but whether or not it's translated into the standard of care, I think is still uncertain. You know, here in Canada, we're kind of in limbo because it's not yet approved or funded in that setting. So we haven't had to actually grapple with it yet ourselves. So in my own clinic, I'm still using rituximab. I think from the colleagues that I speak with in the U.S. who have ready access to it, I think it's a 50-50 thing. I'm hearing that some people have moved on and are now using it up front, whereas others feel that maybe the benefit is still a little marginal and they worry about that trade-off and the slightly higher toxicity, and they're sticking with rituximab. So I think, you know, it's up to doctors to decide where they see the data lying, but it did come out as the preferred and better regimen. In this patient, I'd have to say, there are some features about her that make me worried. So she does have a high-risk FLIPI profile. She is 72. When she relapses, she's not going to be a candidate for an autologous stem cell transplant. And the one interesting thing about the gallium trial and the use of obinutuzumab is that if you look at the shape of those curves, I think it did seem to diminish the risk of earlier relapse in patients. So what we are realizing is that patients that relapse within the first 2 years of treatment do present kind of a bigger problem and are hard to treat and do have shorter survival than patients that get more durable benefit. And so I am enticed by the data suggesting that maybe it's that early risk of relapse that might be diminished with the use of the obinutuzumab, and that would be certainly desirable in this patient.
Where is this patient right now? She completed the maintenance?
Yeah, so this patient is actually still receiving her maintenance therapy, but she's actually done quite well in the combination, and we don't routinely do PET scans in my clinic, so I'd say that she achieved a partial remission by CT scan and is currently receiving maintenance and doing quite well.
So, really interesting dilemma. You mentioned the issue of toxicity, and the other person that's on the same program that you are that I interviewed is Andy Zelenitz, and he raised a concern that I actually haven't heard anybody else raise, which is of the toxicity, specifically deaths in patients who got bendamustine, both with rituximab as well as obinutuzumab, was in the range of 4 to 5%. And he has come to the conclusion that he doesn't want to use bendamustine anymore in follicular lymphoma, which, as you say, and I think is the most common chemotherapy regimen. He's thinking more about RCVP, et cetera. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think you have to be very careful when you look at that data. So that trial was not designed in a way that allows us to examine the difference between the chemotherapy backbone. So it was an institution choice of chemotherapy. So if you participated in that trial, you chose your chemotherapy up front, and everybody at that institution got that chemotherapy. So there was no randomization to the chemotherapy, is what I'm trying to say. What it did mean, though, and when we look at the clinical characteristics of the patients by which chemotherapy they were given, there probably was some patient selection of who was entered in the trial at different institutions. So if you look at the clinical characteristics of patients treated on the trial who received the bendamustine, they actually tended to be a little bit older and had more morbidities. So I don't think that the patients are... So, for example, if an institution had chosen CHOP as their chemotherapy backbone, they probably weren't going to put on their oldest patients on that trial. So there was a selection where those patients probably didn't get on the trial. So I think it's unfair to just look at the chemotherapy arms and then compare the toxicity, because the patients are different. The patients on the bendamustine arm are actually different. But what Dr. Zelenis is concerned about is they did report about a 5% death from toxicity with the bendamustine antibody combinations. And that's, you know, higher than anybody would like to see in an upfront treatment for a disease that is generally indolent and we think the patients can live for a very long time with. And the question is that a real finding? Do we need to be worried about it? Certainly, I think doctors need to be aware of it, that the risk of death actually came from a risk of infection. And those infections, many of them were delayed and fell during the maintenance phase. So I think it's important data to be aware of. And I think that doctors need to take symptoms of infection very seriously in patients who have received bendamustine or rituximab or obinutuzumab, or patients who are ongoing in maintenance. And even after the maintenance finishes, some of those patients can succumb to infection because the immunosuppression can be prolonged. But short of being very vigilant and taking early signs of infection seriously, it hasn't stopped me from using bendamustine, because I think it's a very effective agent. And given the alternatives, I still think that it's a lower toxicity profile compared to using R-CHOP, for example. The one other thing I would say is that we do have more data that's coming out on the use of bendamustine and rituximab. And very recently, at the most recent ASH meeting, we had the STEEL trial presented. And that was the trial that compared bendamustine and rituximab followed by 2 years of maintenance rituximab versus 4 years of maintenance rituximab. The important thing is everybody in that trial got bendamustine rituximab followed by 2 years of maintenance rituximab, and then were randomized to either 2 additional years of maintenance or not. So the nice thing is that's another sort of group of patients that we can look at that received that combination up front to see, you know, do we see the same kind of toxicity? And that trial, you know, we haven't seen published yet. It'll be nice to see the full presentation, but at least what I saw presented at ASH, we weren't seeing quite the same concern for toxic deaths from infection in that group of patients. So I think we need to put all the information together, and it may be that gallium might have overblown the risk a little bit, but I don't want to underscore that risk. I think it has made me much more aware of that potential risk, but it hasn't stopped me from wanting to use the bendamustine.
Getting back to this issue of toxicity, and particularly infusion reactions with obinutuzumab, one of the general oncologists who was attending one of our symposia recently asked a question that I had never thought about before, and I've been asking people recently, and his impression was that the infusion reaction with obinutuzumab was less in patients with follicular lymphoma than it is with CLL. Is that your take?
I think absolutely. You know, you can argue that probably the same thing is true for rituximab to a certain degree, although I think because of the higher risk of the reactions with obinutuzumab, it's probably something that we pay more attention to. But I think undoubtedly the infusion risk is lower in non-Hodgkin lymphoma in general with the obinutuzumab than it is in CLL. And in my clinic, you know, it's been really manageable. So in the trials, we can see that that risk is higher. But from a practical point, when I'm treating a patient, I'd say that they respond just as well to the supportive maneuvers that we administer for patients receiving rituximab. And I don't personally find it to be a very big issue and doesn't dissuade me from using it.
So one final question. Again, I'm still having flashbacks, all those video cases that we presented. And I remember another one was, again, an elderly, frail woman in her 80s with follicular lymphoma. Again, a lot of symptoms, B symptoms from the disease. And the doc elected to use rituximab monotherapy. And we got into the issue of for how long. And the doc actually used it for 2 years. It was a very old, frail patient, you know, wanted to do everything she could at this point. I was kind of surprised because a lot of the people on the faculty panel agreed. And I was thinking back to the resort trial and that whole paradigm of either 4 or maybe 8 doses. How do you approach the issue of R monotherapy? How long do you give it for? And do you think at some point we might be thinking about obinutuzumab monotherapy?
So, you know, we really have no data in terms of clinical trial data to speak to the use of rituximab monotherapy in the kind of patient like you're describing. So the resort trial was done in an asymptomatic patient population who really didn't require therapy, and it compared, of course, a short course of rituximab monotherapy versus rituximab monotherapy and continued maintenance. And it really showed no overall benefit in terms of when the patient was initiated on chemotherapy to giving one or the other. That's a very different question. You're asking in this patient where the rituximab is used instead of kind of a chemotherapy rituximab platform, how long do you give the rituximab for? I do use rituximab monotherapy in my own patients if I really think that they can't tolerate any chemotherapy. Although I have to say that's kind of rare because I think that many patients can tolerate chlorambucil remarkably well, and rituximab and chlorambucil is often what I would use, in which case I'd be giving 6 months of both, so a dose of rituximab with each cycle of the chlorambucil. But if I really thought the patient couldn't tolerate any chemotherapy or, you know, laid down the line and said they didn't want any chemotherapy, I tend to use rituximab monotherapy the way it was developed, and that is as the weekly 4-dose regimen. And a large number of patients respond very nicely to that. And as long as they sustain a benefit of 6 months or longer, if and when they need us to step in again, I would just give them another course of the 4 doses of rituximab. And that actually works very well. There's really no data to say that doing it differently and continuing maintenance after rituximab monotherapy is a better way to go. And again, it's not the same situation, but the resort trial would suggest that there's no value in that route. So it's not what I do. I would use the monotherapy and discrete treatments as needed.
And what do we know about obinutuzumab monotherapy in FL?
Really not much at all. So to my knowledge, there really hasn't been a big monotherapy trial in the untreated setting. We've got data of it as a single agent primarily done in relapsed refractory disease, and then subsequently was developed as a combination regimen. So we know that, at least for follicular lymphoma combined with chemotherapy, it seems to be a better antibody. We know that from the Gadolin trial, you know, in patients who are refractory to rituximab, it seems to offer real benefit. So if you think that there's a role for rituximab monotherapy, and if obinutuzumab is a better antibody, then it stands to reason that maybe obinutuzumab monotherapy would actually be even a better choice. But there's really no data to speak to that.